Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how meditation exposes the fallacy of medicating kids diagnosed with ADHD. And this is a report from Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. I think you'll find it interesting. Also today, there is a nutrient that has now been found in citrus peels that inhibits the oxidation of the LDL cholesterol, and that means you're going to have healthier endothelial cells, the cells that line the blood vessels. I'll explain this. This was done at the University of Naples. And then the positive effect of intermittent fasting in ischemic stroke. Now, stroke is a very common condition. In fact, it's the second leading cause of death from heart conditions outside of heart attacks and congestive heart failure in the world. So if we can stop some of those strokes, even 10% by fasting, that's a big deal. University of Singapore. And also, nature benefits your health. Nature makes you healthier and happier. And we'll explain how's that happen. Also, a good night's sleep keeps your stem cells young. Well, we want young stem cells. I'll explain how that works. From our audio file today, we'll have a executive director of Equal Justice, Brian Stevenson, shares his insights upon justice in America. And then how to jam the Trump brand with Naomi Klein. And it is the double standard practiced by the West regarding terrorism that is killing people in Syria. And also from the Young Turks, they tell us how left-wing group betrayed progressives. We'll listen to part of that. Also today, I'm going to share some commentaries, one of my own, and Professor Henry Giroux on towards a politics of ungovernability. We're getting there. And from our environmental segment today, abrupt climate change is happening faster than before. My guest in the second part of our program today will be David Swanson. And David is going to talk about the Trump administration's military adventures and the rise of the neocons in the Trump White House. Well, they've been there. They were there all along. They were there during Clinton's 8 years, Bush Jr.'s 8 years, and Obama's 8 years. It's just that you didn't recognize them. They didn't have to purge anyone. They were the silent hand. Now they have taken complete control of this presidency. And those who are not of the same mindset have been pushed out. So what is it likely to be? What can you reasonably expect from this presidency and the neocons that control the military-industrial complex? They control the foundations, the think tanks, where all these retired generals and joint chiefs of staff and admirals go. So it's their game. We're paying for it with our lives and our currency. We'll have that in our discussion with my guest. We always try to take on the issues that impact people all over the world. And we listen to what you have to say. And that's why we produce the programs we do. Now let's go to what we always like, and that is starting with health and healing. It's my opinion that we could substantially increase our life expanse and also reduce the impact of all the toxins on our body. First, we have to recognize they are toxins, and then we have to recognize how those toxins interplay. Well, one of the toxins that are entering children today in astronomical quantities is aluminum. Now, by itself, aluminum is a neurotoxic. It is also capable of destroying enzyme systems in the body, it is capable of causing cancer. We're giving that in most of the vaccines, in some vaccines at very high doses. Now, if you were to look at the fact that every vaccine in America is giving in the same dosage, you could be 500 pounds and a football player, or you could be 7 pounds as a new baby. You're given the same dose. That's completely unscientific. There is no science base for that. Also, there is no science that supports the idea that every ingredient in a vaccine has been tested for safety and efficacy. It's just a myth. So one of the side effects of having that many vaccines at such an early age, you don't necessarily end up with autism spectrum disorder. Remember, autism is not a condition. Autism is a spectrum of conditions. And on that spectrum, you can have what we call ADHD or ADD, where you're simply so agitated that you can't sit still. And yet any major effort to try to find a physiological cause, they're going to miss, because this is hidden deep within the brain where there's been some damage. It can impact the central nervous system with some damage, but none of it can you measure. You can't see it. There's no blood test to determine it. So then we end up one day drugging 10 million children before they go to school. And the most common diagnosis is ADHD. Well, I believe that ADHD, when it does exist, is only maximum 5%. And that's due to environmental damage, including vaccines. I believe 95% of all diagnoses are simply not allowing a child to be a normal kid today. We expect kids to behave a certain way. And when they don't, then we want to drug them into behaving a certain way. Experts cannot agree on a single, simple definition of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. According to Natural Blaze, they do agree that it causes unfavorable behavior in educational and professional and correctional institutions. Even the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the Bible of Psychiatric Diagnosis, defines it using a multiple choice test for an array of behavioral symptoms and demonstrating its clinical ambiguity. Is a mental illness or a learning disability? Is it environmental or hereditary? Is it curable or not? They can't answer any of this, but they sure can drug it. And it is best thought of as a description. If you look at how you end up with that label, it is remarkable, because any one of us at any given time would fit a couple of those criteria. And Dr. Bruce Perry, MD, PhD, explained it this way, that it's, quote, it is fictitious, fraudulent disease altogether. Quote, ADHD is fraud intended to justify starting children on a life of drug addiction. Dr. Edward Hamlin, founding member of the Royal College of General Practitioners. You don't get more important or more significant in the medical community in Great Britain. You just heard him say, it's a fraud. Then you have Dr. Richard Saul, quote, after 50 years of practicing medicine, seeing thousands of patients demonstrating symptoms of ADHD, I have reached the conclusion there is no such thing as ADHD. And some physicians openly admit to falsely diagnosing kids with ADHD, not because they have an identifiable condition which could be properly treated with medication, but because they need to somehow improve the child's behavior in order for the child to better adapt to the educational environment. Leading the way is Dr. Michael Anderson, a pediatrician in the Atlanta area. Incredibly, Anderson told the New York Times his diagnosis of ADHD, quote, are made up, an excuse to hand out drugs. Quote, we've decided as a society that it's too expensive to modify the child's environment, so we have to modify the kid. Well, you give him drugs? Think of that. That's remarkable. And while new ADHD drugs are being rolled out and industry profits swelling, diagnosis of ADHD in American children also continue to rise dramatically. And now, even babies are being medicated to modify their behavior. The presumption among the medical establishment is that ADHD is best addressed with psychiatric drugs, in spite of the fact that evidence indicates ADHD drugs do not help kids get better grades. And so kids should have something else. What about meditating? This last year, an elementary school in West Baltimore made international news by replacing detention with meditation and reporting incredible results. Behavioral complaints against a student is typically the basis for referring a child to an ADHD specialist, and in this case, meditation improved overall behavior at the school. Instead of punishing them or sending them to the principal's office, administrators will now be sending the children to the mindful moment room where they will be able to meditate and wind down. The new policy has been in place for over a year, and in that time, the meditation room has been set up. There has actually been no suspensions, none, not one, throughout the entire year. And David Lynch Foundation brought TM to 900 inmates in the Oregon State Correction Institution. The results were impressive, with participants remarking on an improved quality of life, an improved focus, and most importantly, on feeling of peace, leading to less stress and more peace in an ordinarily difficult-to-manage environment. And comparing meditation to medication, there was a video produced by the David Lynch Foundation that shows how transcendental meditation is used experimentally in Kingsbury Day School in Washington, D.C., a school for children with language-based learning disabilities. And twice a day, the regular school program stops and the children meditate using transcendental meditation, TM, for just 10 minutes with incredible results and without the use of pharmaceutical ADHD medications. So my final thoughts are this. There are simple, natural ways of treating the broad and ambiguous array of behavioral issues we refer to as ADHD. Improving diet, getting rid of the sugar, and common allergens like dairy and meat. Tutoring and increased physical exercise. Actually having recess in school and letting kids go out and scream and yell and play. That's what kids are supposed to do. They can all have a noticeable impact. However, meditation is coming into the forefront as one of the best natural treatments, as it can actually retrain the brain to concentrate and focus, thereby increasing performance and reducing frustration. After all, meditation is the practice of concentration, while ADHD is the lack of concentration. And let's go back now almost 7 years, where I had a health support group just for ADHD and ADD challenged children. To get into the study group, you had to have a diagnosis. You had to be under treatment and under medication. They came with their parents. Within 3 months, there was 90% of the children were not taking their medication. Their family physicians took them off because they were not manifesting the symptoms. And it was really, from my perspective, simple, because we had playtime, and then we also had quiet time, and just listening to very soft meditative music. Something simple like a rainstorm, where they close their eyes and you put on a CD of a thunderstorm, or waterfalls, or a pond in a forest with frogs and crickets. The kids just calm down and relax, taking them off gluten and dairy and sugars, and rebuilding their gut, rebuilding the mitochondria and the proper and healthy bacteria 4 or 5 times a day, and then helping with folic acid, a folate, a methylated folate, one milligram, and 1 milligram of B12, a methylated, and suddenly we had normal acting children. But one of the people there was a teacher, and she had her son. Son was on Ritalin. And so I simply asked the son, I said, are there any classes you like more than others? He said, yes. How many do you like? He said, I like 2 classes. And all the others you don't? No, I'm bored, I don't like them. Now, when you're in those classes you're bored with, what do you think about? And he was telling me all the things he thinks about. And I said, now when you're outside of class, are you bored? He said, no, we do a lot, me and my friends. And I said, when you get home at night, no, he gets on his computer, he's doing all this stuff. Are you bored? No. Do you have your symptoms all the time, 24/7? Because if it's an actual disease, like cancer, or like, for example, heart disease, you have it all the time. You don't have cancer in the morning, but then it goes away in the afternoon, then it comes back at night, then it goes away in the morning. You have it or you don't have it. He said, no, there are times I'm fine. I asked the mother, is he like always hyper? No, there are times when he's fine. Well, did it ever occur to anyone that maybe he's bored with all these classes, and so when he's in something he's engaged in and he's liking, like playing and activities, the computer, his brain is working normal. So you've misdiagnosed him. He didn't have any brain chemical imbalance. He has a boredom. The classroom is not as exciting as his outside world or as his brain world. So that's where all of education has to pay attention. All teachers have to pay attention. Are you up to the challenges of the new young people who have a lot more stimulation? And therefore, you have to look at that. In any case, the mother said her kid stopped bouncing off the wall 3 weeks into the program and hasn't been diagnosed since. From the University of Naples, there is a nutrient. It is called nobilitin, N-O-B-I-L-E-T-I-N. It comes from citrus peels, and it is good for your endothelial cells. And the researchers detail the new data in the peer-reviewed journal Endothelial Cells, and, quote, the flavonoids are nutrients usually included in human diet with several significant biological activities. This particular one is a flavonoid compound in citrus peels that, besides having anti-inflammatory and anti-tumor activity, seem to exert protective effect on the cardiovascular system, end quote. Wow, that's good news. That means that all of you who've been following the juicing protocols I've been advocating, 2 of those juices a day are citrus. 1 is with your grapefruit, with green apple, and lemon, and ginger. The other is watermelon, and lemon lime, and grapefruit. And always juice, get organic, always juice the whole fruit, including the yellow-orange, the yellow, or the orange-orange, and the yellow lemon, and the green lime, and the yellow grapefruit, the skin. Now, if you do that, you do the peel, you're getting the nobilitin, and that's helping your heart. And finally, from the University of Singapore, new research on aging, geriatrics, and gerontology, they found that periodic fasting, what they call intermittent fasting, quote, is a dietary protocol where energy restriction is induced by alternative periods of ad libitum, feeding, and fasting. Proteolytic intermittent fasting has been shown to extend lifestyle and attenuate the progress and severity of age-related diseases such as cardiovascular disease, stroke, myocardial infarction, and neurodegenerative diseases, end quote. Now, in lay language, what this means is that when you take 1 day a week, it's this simple, And instead of eating any solid food that day, you simply have juices. You can have some plant-based protein in the morning. You can have the same thing in the afternoon. Get yourself maybe 20 grams of protein in the morning, 20 in the afternoon. You get your protein taken care of. And then you have a variety of either fruit juices, fresh-made or organic, or compounded powders to make them, or vegetable juices. And that way you're resting the system by not exerting a high caloric intake. So when you reduce calories going into the body rejuvenates and you live longer. So that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you who are just joining us. Nice to have you with us. It was 8 years ago that I began to do extensive in-depth scholarship for a new documentary and new book. I'm just completing the documentary and the book. Both will be released sometime in the next 9 months. It's taken a long time because there were so many uncertainties. For example, if you look at the majority of scientists involving environmental research, they tend to be conservative in their views on the environment. When you speak to them one-on-one, off the record, they give you a different story. The moment that camera goes on and they're recording, they tend to pull back by several measures of caution. Yet what they tell me privately is what I take seriously. Now, why would they have two views, one that they share with the public or before Congress or someplace else, and one that they have when they're talking with you? Because they're afraid of several things. As one recently told me, what's the average person who has no background or experience supposed to do? They don't know what to do. They can't even understand the complexities of these feedback loops. Secondly, no government is in the United States, and most worldwide will never tell the citizens the truth, because if you were told the truth in California, in Florida, in other places where you're extremely vulnerable, in Oklahoma, in Kansas, in Colorado, that you don't have a future that you can predict is going to be safe and sustainable. You're going to have flooding. And what would that do to property values? They would plummet. What would that do to income from the taxes from that real estate? They would plummet. What would happen to bureaucracies? They would go into a sinkhole. What would happen to municipal bonds? They wouldn't be redeemable. What would happen to little cities and large cities? They would declare bankruptcy. And then you start a roller coaster ride down on this. So by necessity, political necessity, knowing that people have a lot of fear of change, they're not going to move. They're going to stay where they're at, and they're going to say, well, we'll weather the storm. No, you won't. The storms that we're about to face in the near future, nobody will weather. So they're not telling you the full story. And those who are generally not heard in the mainstream media. But after a period of time now, especially in the last 12 months, I have more and more going public about how short a time we have. As far as I can determine at this moment, major cataclysmic events around the world will start to happen within the next 10 years. We are already losing 200 species every 24 hours. Every 24 hours, 200 species. In 10 years from now, you won't find orangutans, rhinoceros, hippos, and elephants in the wild, lions. They'll be gone. They'll be gone because some idiots in China believe that somehow having a soup made of tiger bones allows you to have virility. It's all stupid. None of it's real. And yet the governments won't ban it because they're utterly corrupt. The Chinese government in particular is utterly corrupt. They're not going to make any changes. In fact, all governments are corrupt. No one's going to make a change because of some animal. They don't care about the animals. They care about that development. They care about the palm oil and how much money is made out. They care about hydrofracking. They care about what is commodifiable. animals are not a part of the equation. Poor people are not a part of the equation, as we've seen from the principles of gentrification. So what this comes down to is the following. We are now in chaos theory. What does that mean? It means that, no, the world is not going to end in 10 years. What will happen is, for large parts of the world, you will simply not be able to sustain life as we know it. It'll be too hot or too flooded. The soil will be too salty. The underground aquifers will be filled with saline, salt. You won't be able to do that water source anymore. You'd have to create a desalinization plant. Most countries cannot afford that for their full population. So you're going to have an enormous amount of movement. We're talking about hundreds of millions, if not at least 1 to 2 billion people moving. Where are they supposed to go? Who's supposed to take them in? How are they supposed to be housed and fed? How's their culture supposed to be assimilated into the existing culture? None of these questions are being addressed. So imagine the chaos on that level that's ahead. Now, for those who have enough wealth, those who are smart enough to be on top of the information now, they can make appropriate plans. They can start planning the best places to live and where and how to get there so that they're not overwhelmed and blindsided. But for everyone else, this is about what's going to happen. This is from Bruce Melton from Truth Out. Quote, in about the last 100,000 years, there have been 23 abrupt temperature changes in Greenland ice cores. In those moments, the temperature abruptly jumped or fell 9 to 14 degrees Fahrenheit across the planet and 25 to 35 degrees Fahrenheit in Greenland. The changes typically took decades to generations, but at their most extreme, they only took 2 to 3 years. Counterintuitively, published consensus statements on climate change do not factor in abrupt change, an omission that is seriously affecting how climate policy is made. The reason is that we do not yet have the skill to model abrupt changes, even though ample robust evidence exists of the common occurrence of abrupt change in prehistory. It may seem unimaginable that these most important of all climate changes have been disregarded in climate policy, but this is the way the culture of the climate science consensus works. Policy is based upon impacts that we project to happen in the future through modeling. But weather models are not climate models. It's not the modeling. It's not that the modeling cannot project the future. Climate modeling is actually quite accurate. It's weather modeling that goes awry after about 5 days. However, there are major differences in techniques for predicting weather, and we're just not doing it. So here's the bottom line. This past year, in the last 12 months, we had 7 abrupt weather changes, so extreme, so severe, there was no modeling. Hence, there was no prevention. Hence, there was no insurance. There was no protection. There was no evacuations. There was no caution. There was nothing. One day, people went to bed. Everything was fine. And the next day, they were flooded out in a once-in-a-500-year flood. We had 7 once-in-500-year events in the last 12 months. So here is my thought. I believe that based upon the best evidence at hand, that based upon now we finding out that there is enormous heat under Antarctica, warming it from below, there is thinning on top, there are lakes in the middle of the ice, and now the largest single buffer, the Larsen B Shelf, which is now measured 110 miles long, 3/4 mile deep, 300 yards wide, will break off imminently, meaning today, tomorrow, within the next couple weeks, a month. When that becomes the largest iceberg in history to break off, all that behind it on a steep elevation, the glacier, is going to start sliding into the water. There's nothing to hold it back. There's no backstopping it. When that happens, it will accelerate. Once it accelerates, you'll be into these unpredicted extreme events that happen abruptly. And so one night you go to bed, and the next morning you wake up, and the water in the ocean is 2 feet higher. Now, once that starts, it won't stop. And then all the people who are going to say, why didn't you know? Why didn't you predict it? Where were your models? Why didn't you give us warning? We could have gotten out of here 5 years ago. You said we had 100 years. We'd have been dead. So now I just want to let you know, this audience, you have been warned. Life as you know it, for most Americans on the planet, will not be sustainable within 10 years. But between now and 10 years, we could have such extreme, abrupt climate change that it will be catastrophic for those people who are affected. I predict we're going to have at least one or more Category 5 hurricanes hitting with full force, no veering off, like Katrina was only a 3 when it hit. Sandy was a 1. Could you imagine New York getting hit with Category 5? So I'm making a suggestion that in a reasonable, a responsible manner, you begin to look at what your government, your federal, state, and local government refuses to, what your foundations and organizations and think tanks refuse to do, what the media refuses to do is look at the truth that we have so altered our planet's temperatures. We have so polluted the ocean. We have acidified the ocean. We've destroyed 75% of all coral reefs, including the Great Coral Reef off Australia. We have caused billions of fish to die just in the last 12 months because of rising temperatures in the ocean. We have had hundreds of thousands of mammals in the water, like sea lions and whales and dolphins and porpoises dying from starvation because their food chain has been disrupted. We have had massive destruction in Louisiana, where of all the parishes, which are counties, none were covered by flood insurance because they had never flooded. 63,000 homes were adversely affected or destroyed in one parish alone. We have massive drought in areas of the world. So we're not paying attention. I think you should. And if you do it on your own and look at how many qualified scientists out there on environmental issues are telling you this is happening, and those who are not being highly protective or very conservative, just telling you the truth, they'll tell you we're now in chaos. Theory. No accurate predictions. One final thing before we take a break. I remember being on PBS, Colorado Public Television, and I was suggesting on air that we begin to pay attention to the idea that because you're up in the mountains of 5,000 feet does not mean you're protected. You're not protected from flooding. You're not protected from drought. You're not protecting from a beetle devastating your forest. It may all seem beautiful now, and all the beautiful rich people go up to, you know, Aspen and Telluride to the film festival, and that's all cool, but that could change. Now, I remember being nudged by the co-host, and when we went to a break, the co-host says, none of that's relevant here. Don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. Okay, I didn't. 2 weeks later, the biggest flood in Colorado history happened. 3,200 homes were washed away, exclusive homes in this whole valley where a mud, 22-foot-high wall of mud came down, took everything out of its way. Colorado is now in one of its worst droughts. Beetles are infestating the trees and destroying them. And the water from the Colorado, which feeds over 30 million people, including in Nevada and other states, it's down. Lake Mead is down. Everything is down. And interesting how prophetic that was. So then they invited me back to talk about this. And they began to play Seeds of Death. And they played it over 80 times. The most any environmental documentary has ever been played on the air in American history. And they still have people watching because it was a wake-up call. And once something gets your absolute undivided attention, you pay attention. So I'm just suggesting, unless you're very rich and you can buy places where you know that there's probably going to be little or no major change, and still continue your quality of life, you are going to be surprised living in Miami, New York, Washington, Savannah. A lot of cities are going to be inundated with tidal surges. And in Oklahoma, Kansas, Western Texas, Montana, Wyoming, gas hydrofracking earthquakes, the worst earthquake in Kansas history, 4.9, they finally determined was due to gas hydrofracking. And they put 5,000 hydrofracking wells in 1 year. So we just don't seem capable as a society to making any change. We may want to, but we're not. We're not using paper or hemp instead of plastic. We're not reducing our consumption. Everybody wants the latest iPhones and everything else that has to be exploited somewhere else in the world where they're natural minerals or human labor. We all want the latest, and without any conscious thought of, will that in any way negatively impact nature, animals, humans, or the environment? So I think a lot of people are going to look up in the near future the word karma, because they'll be living it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're now going down to Charlottesville, Virginia, where David Swanson is standing by. He is one of our most important social and political activists in the liberal progressive movement. He served as Dennis Kucinich's press secretary during his presidential campaign and is the communication coordinator for the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, better known as ACORN, from 2000 to 2003. David spearheaded the exposure of the Downing Street memos to the attention of the U.S. government, and he had led an ongoing campaign to impeach Bush and Cheney. David is the founder of World Beyond War and is the campaign coordinator for Roots Action, an online grassroots initiative to galvanize people to promote economic fairness and equal rights and environmental protection. His website is davidswanson.org, and his most recent book is War is Never Just, which challenges the just war theory that we may recall Obama endorsed during his Nobel Award speech, and his bestseller, War is a Lie, recently went into second edition. Nice to have you with us today, David.
Hi, Gary. Great to be here.
David, Trump ran primarily as an isolationist with respect to foreign affairs, aside from his hard stance against terrorism, perhaps because Steve Bannon had his ear. Now, during the campaign, Trump did not come off appearing as a part of the neocon establishment at all, including his position to seek reconciliation with Putin through diplomacy. But here we are, 3 months, and everything has changed. We are now witnessing an escalation of military might through the Middle East, in particular in Syria, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Yemen. And Iran seems to be the administration's ultimate target. And Bannon has been pushed to the sidelines. We're now seeing the neocons who were supporting Hillary Clinton, and Clinton would go to their foundations and think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, and the Heritage Institute, and give talks for them before her election. And I'm thinking of Robert Kagan and Henry Kissinger, the two leading superstars of the neocon pro-war agenda, supporting Trump's recent assaults in Syria and elsewhere, as well as flipping his early position on Russia. Kagan is blaming Obama for not doing what we are now observing Trump doing, and Trump's ratings as of this morning are 50%. So the question is, what is going on in the White House, foreign affairs and defense apparatus? Is it that Trump never had a concise foreign policy to begin with? Is it because he nominated weak and inexperienced imbeciles to run the federal government? Or is there perhaps something else going on that we're missing, such as Trump being a neocon in disguise all along? What is your understanding about his 180-degree turnaround and now taking orders from the neocon establishment?
Well, I'm going to go with D, all of the above, and I think your portrait is broadly accurate, but I would be wary of the 180-degree turn absolutist statement there. I mean, you'll recall that during the campaign, the two candidates were both kissing up to and being friends with people like Henry Kissinger. While Donald Trump was saying he opposed this dumb war and that dumb war, he was promising more military spending, which, if anybody bothers to look at the historical record, always produces more wars, not fewer. He was promising to kill their families, to steal their oil. I mean, this was the peace candidate, which, and of course you could make a plausible argument that the other candidate was even more of a warmonger, but there was no peace candidate among the two of them, or even the three of them, if you throw Bernie Sanders in there, although he was relatively better than the other two. And we also saw in Donald Trump's campaign every indication that he would do anything the media would love. I mean, this was a candidate handed the nomination by the major corporate media outlets who found him entertaining and good for ratings. Now they hate him, but if he bombs something, they love him, and he's learned that, and he will do whatever it takes to get media love and media attention, and the easiest way to do that is to start wars. Now, it is certainly true that the silver lining in the foreseeable catastrophe of President Trump was that he wasn't quite as hateful toward Russia as Hillary Clinton, Russia being the other major nuclear-armed government on Earth. That, of course, as you note, has been largely reversed by Trump's inclination to do whatever NATO and the Pentagon and the neocons and the establishment want him to do. And that includes, yes, building up hostility towards Iran. But I would be very wary of picking, you know, which is the next big war. This is someone threatening to bomb North Korea, threatening hostility to China and Russia, and further hostilities in Ukraine and Syria and Iraq and Yemen and Somalia and Sudan. I mean, there are more wars than we can keep up with, and we have to sort of get beyond this notion of finding the dumb ones and opposing them and start opposing the entire institution of war making.
Appreciate that overview. Thank you. We may remember that the neocons who stacked the Bush administration didn't hold back from engaging military confrontation whenever the opportunity availed itself. So would you explain the long-term strategy the neocon agenda has for the Middle East and aggression also towards Russia and China? And has it changed at all since the Bush White House? And if so, in what ways?
Well, since the Bush White House, you've, of course, had 8 years of Obama, who invented entirely new forms of warfare, like drone warfare, who made advances in propaganda and acceptability of illegality, so that you now go to war without any sort of congressional authorization, but also without any sort of pretense of NATO, as if that were a legalizing element, or UN. And in some cases, a sort of a humanitarian war propaganda bait and switch, style of, pretending the Libyan government is about to massacre civilians, getting some sort of authorization to protect them, and then going in and overthrowing a government and creating a disaster that, of course, lasts to this day. I think the general inclination of the pro-military and weapons-funded establishment in D.C., call them neocons, call them neoliberals, call them traditional Americans, is to dominate the globe. And there are some spots that don't look sufficiently dominated. If you look at a map of the globe at where U.S. bases are lacking, where U.S. military alliances are lacking, you know, places like Syria and Iran leap out at you. And so these are in the crosshairs. But so is North Korea. And, you know, this is a a risking of nuclear confrontation with North Korea or with China or with Russia. And you've got a, you know, an absolute imbecile in the White House. I mean, this is the fulfillment of the columnist from Baltimore, H.L. Mencken, who said, you know, one day Americans will get their true heart's desire and elect an absolute imbecile to the White House. And yes, he seems to take whatever advice he was most recently given by whoever was in the room with him. And most of the people he lets in rooms with him, if not all, are warmongers.
Well, I would say that we also have to include in that imbecilic list Ronald Reagan and George Bush Jr. He should not be completely alone in that. Trump's hasty bombing of the Syrian government's airfield received applause. What was interesting is how many Democrats, how many liberals came out and said, well done, we needed to do it. MSNBC. And, of course, everyone at Fox News and the other side of it. And all the mainstream media outlets praised it. And it really makes us question the legitimacy of the Democratic Party any longer as an alternative antidote to countering Trump. And although I personally believe that the demise of the Democrats as a party of the people rests with the Clinton administration, Hillary ran as a staunch neocon, and her legacy as Secretary of State proves it. So does the Democratic Party even have a foreign policy agenda any longer, or is it simply near identical to Trump's Defense Department now, except with a softer image and more rhetoric before it happens? And finally, everyone in the media starts off their comments that the Syrian fiasco happened because of what Syria did, Assad did to his own people. Well, Ray McGovern, who I'm sure you're familiar with, Ray is a 20-year former CIA analyst. In fact, he was the top person who presented the papers to the president's National Security Advisor each day, and he did it under 7 administrations. He is still connected with a large group of former and current intelligence agents, and he said that the agents on the ground said that it would not have been possible for Assad to have done this. And the most likely scenario was that under a new agreement, Russia, Syria, and the United States share intelligence about where they're at in the planes, what they're bombing, so they don't inadvertently attack each other. And the Americans knew that this particular site was going to be bombed, when it was going to be bombed, and who was going to bomb it. What the Syrians who bombed it didn't know was this was an al-Qaeda place that not only had weapons, but also had it had chemicals that were going to be used for chemical warfare. And that was an unintended consequence of the bombing. So had they stopped and done their actual intelligence work, their forensic work, they would have known that. In fact, there's an intelligence group in place now to do that kind of forensic work. They were never called upon to do it. No one was called upon to do any research at all. Immediately, they said that Assad did it with no actual forensic proof. And so put that into your equation of how the media is willing to support conclusions and foreign policy initiatives, including bombing a place, and without the evidence being there to support it.
Well, I will try to speak to a few of those things, or I'll put everybody to sleep and we'll be here all day. But I think the support that you see from both so-called separate parties and across the U.S. population for a bombing that has happened the night before is always dramatically different from support for a proposed possible bombing for next week sometime. And I think that speaks to the dramatic difference in polling between now and 4 years ago on bombing Syria. I think the answer on the Democratic Party is very short and simple. Abandon it. Forget it. Absolutely erase the idea of continuing to question it and let it rest in peace. We need policy-based, independent activism. We need to confront these Congress critters and senators while they are home in their districts and in their states until the 24th of this month, as done 4 years ago that stopped the bombing of Syria. We need to, you know, confront the Democrats and Republicans equally, primary them, push for electoral reforms that allow us to unseat them. I think this notion that someone killing their own people, as if that's somehow worse than killing somebody else's people, and killing them with a banned weapon, as if that's somehow worse or less legal or less moral than killing them with some non-banned weapon, is something we need to overcome. They have got everybody chasing after the wrong rabbit here. Ray McGovern chases it better than anyone else I know, I think. But if it were proven that Bashar al-Assad personally committed this crime and it was on videotape and he was confessing to it, that would do absolutely nothing whatsoever to render legal, moral, or practical escalating or continuing or participating or launching any war anywhere on earth against anyone for any reason. Warfare is the greatest crime there is, and it is not legalized by anybody's use or possession of some weapon. The chemical weapons, as it happens, are no more indiscriminate than U.S. bombs, with which the U.S. government has been killing large numbers of people in Syria and Iraq for many years now, and there is nothing unique or particularly egregious about this one bombing of an airstrip that killed a relatively small number of people. Yes, clearly they do not, I mean, the White House does not have evidence that Assad committed this crime. We don't have definitive evidence to persuade everyone or to be absolutely confident that he didn't. The point is the U.S. government doesn't want to know. And because they don't want to know and they want to go ahead with a rush to war, just as they didn't want to know who blew up the USS Maine, and it doesn't matter who did it. The point is Spain wanted to go to arbitration and the U.S. wanted a war. We have to get beyond, you know, obsessing with the evidence that Assad didn't do it to the illegality and immorality of mass murdering people in Syria as if there were some sort of grounds for doing so. And we need to push for actual diplomacy and aid instead of a particular type of warfare in Syria. Every type is going to be counterproductive, and that's been proven the case for years now as the U.S. has sabotaged every possible peace agreement, sometimes President Obama, sometimes the military in apparent defiance of his wishes, and since then Trump and the military, with or without Trump say-so. The Syrian government has been far more open to peace negotiations than the U.S. government has. And that's what we should work on changing.
Okay, well said. Thank you. The Pentagon recently dropped the GBU-43, the MOAB 22,000-pound bomb on Afghanistan, being called the mother of all bombs, 30 feet in length. It's supposed to be the largest non-nuclear weapon in the United States warhead arsenal. And this was being dropped upon supposedly terrorists, not a standing army. We haven't touched upon the destructive power of this weapon, so I'd like for you to tell us your position on this. And what is the destructive capability, and what is the likelihood that civilian deaths are much higher than the mainstream media or Defense Department is telling us? And doesn't Russia have a similar bomb? And if we're willing to use it indiscriminately against, let's say, roving Muslim jihadists, what does this portend for our aggressive and perhaps militaristic posturing against Russia and more recently against North Korea?
Yeah, good question. I'm not going to use the term "our" to refer to these crimes because I'm against them and I don't have any hostility toward Russia. I'm going to Russia to visit people there in a couple of weeks. Russia does indeed have a larger bomb than this one. The United States also has a larger bomb. This is its second largest non-nuclear bomb. Even more dangerous is the fact that the U.S. military is developing smaller nuclear bombs that it speaks about as being more were usable and threatening to use them, and unlike other nations, has a policy of first use of nuclear weapons. You have 132 nations working on a treaty at the UN to ban nuclear weapons. The only nuclear-armed government that voted to proceed with drafting that treaty was North Korea, not the United States, which has tried to sabotage it. Are we still going here?
Yes, we are.
Sorry, I was hearing voices. Maybe it's my phone. Maybe it's the Russians. Damn them. Yes, it's outrageous that Donald Trump is, you know, apparently one of these people who cannot distinguish television from reality. And if you watch U.S. television and Hollywood movies, you would imagine that blowing stuff up solves problems, and the bigger the explosion, the more problems you solve. And he now is going to be looking to blow up something bigger or drop two of those, you know, $320 million, right, for one of these bombs. And they're claiming to have killed, what, 32 people or so with it. There is no question that civilians were killed. There is no question that human beings were killed. There is no question that hard work by the CIA decades back digging these tunnels was destroyed. The problem is, what is this guy going to do next? The optimistic segment you did just before I came on about environmental catastrophe, we're going to be lucky if we get there without nuclear apocalypse if these guys continue down this path. We have to get rid of these weapons, and we have to confront the biggest destroyer of the Earth's climate that we've got, which is the U.S. military. So it's wonderful that peace has become part of this climate march that's going to be happening on April 29th. And I would encourage people to get involved in that and to see protecting the environment and protecting peace as one combined movement.
I would agree. The book is War is Never Just, and the second edition of War is a Lie. The website is davidswanson.org. We look forward to our next discussion, David. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Have a good day.